Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, controller. Are you ready to begin?
All engines are started.
That looks really good.
So we'd like it to stir up your cryo tank.
Oh, wow, really, it's going up so slowly.
The state of the space flyer during the flight is being observed with the help of radio, telemetry, and television devices.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Welcome to Space Boffins with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
Later, we celebrate a moon landing anniversary, but not the one you might think. We also hear about a rover marathon on Mars and talk to a scientist working on Europe's latest mission to the Red Planet.
Our guest is the author of a new book that tells the story of the most advanced flying machine ever built, the Space Shuttle. Roland White, welcome to Space Boffins. Now, your book, Into the Black, which is here to prove it, focuses for a large part on the first shuttle flight of, April 1981. And that was really an audacious flight in the whole history of space flight.
Very much so. As far as Chris Kraft was concerned, the head of Johnson Space Center, one of the two most audacious, bold flights that he'd ever been involved in, the other being Apollo 8, of course. I mean, it was the first and only time that a spacecraft has been launched either by the Russians or by the Americans or indeed the Chinese that's never first been tested in unmanned form first. And I suppose it's going to be the only time that ever will happen. So, not for nothing, known as the boldest test flight in history.
Well, on board that test flight, STS-1, was Commander John Young, who'd previously flown in Gemini 3, Gemini 10, Apollo 10 and walked on the moon during Apollo 16. Alongside him, pilot Bob Crippen on his first space mission. And the flight lasted a total of 2 days and 6 hours. And here it is in 2 minutes, 20 seconds, including an extract from the superb day 3 wake up call.
Mr. Mark, is that you copy me,
John? Yeah, I'm clear, George. It's not good.
Hey, I have a message here for both of you from the President. You go forward this morning in a daring enterprise, and you take the hopes and prayers of all Americans with you.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start.
Houston, you're going throttle up.
Roger, going throttle up.
Roger, Columbia on a nice ride. You're lofting a little bit. You'll probably be slightly high at staging.
1 minute, 45 seconds. Coming up on go, no, go.
Columbia, you're negative seats.
That call up says Columbia, the altitude is too high for ejection seat use.
Columbia, Houston, you're go for nominal ohms 1 and for APU shutdown on time.
From what we can see above wings, tops and leading edges, all those are fully intact.
That report from John Young showing a few of the missing tiles, also he reported...
Good morning, boy.
Oh, John.
Creepy.
Time to wake up.
Time to get up for the big splashdown today.
And both of you could use a shower.
Smells like Young's been into the instant breakfast drink again.
John and Crippler, 30 seconds from LOS. Want to report that Columbia is in super shape, almost no write-ups. We want her back in the hangar, and you have a preliminary go for the burn.
Okey-doke, Joe, and we concur. Fly
5, 4, 3, touchdown. Welcome home, Skipper.
Houston, Columbia's on the roller.
Welcome home, Columbia. Beautiful, beautiful.
The flight of the first space shuttle, that day three wake-up, probably the, well, it depends what you see it. I think it's one of the best ever.
I think it sounds like it's put together by Tim Burton.
Yeah, could well
it is extraordinary. It was put together
Timmy
by
Mallet.
Local Houston DJs, Hudson and Harrigan. I'd quite like to know. I might do a bit of digging, find out what happened to them. Now, that first flight, we got the impression there. All fantastic. All went really well, Roland. But actually, the shuttle, on its first flight, lost several protective tiles, and there were real concerns that the heat shield was damaged.
Absolutely, and they weren't really sure about the extent to which it might be, nor were they sure when they discovered on orbit that there were tiles missing, what had caused it. And there's only so much you can test before you actually fly. And really, those first four space shuttle flights, first one obviously being the most significant of those, were a way of demonstrating whether or not this system worked. And so when they got into orbit and opened the payload bay doors and looked back from the flight deck, and it was evident there were a handful of tiles missing from the rocket pods, the orbital maneuvering system pods, it was unclear whether or not that signified that there were tiles missing from a more important part of the heat shield. And so while during press conferences NASA's tone was fairly reassuring, there was a frantic effort going on behind the scenes to try and discover, first of all, whether or not the tiles they knew were missing were going to cause problems on re-entry, but also whether or not there were tiles missing from another part of the airframe. And NASA themselves had no way of knowing that.
And they used telescopes, didn't they, on the ground, this Department of Defense
They did.
Equipment.
I mean, they used, and they were, Gene Kranz in the press conferences spoke openly about the use of some telescopes, but not others. So some telescopes, like the one in on Big Sur in California, was something they could talk about openly, and that was used to track ballistic missiles. The telescopes that there were in Florida and in Hawaii, they weren't able to talk about openly. And those were ones which were used by the Air Force to take pictures of spacecraft on orbit. But something that was alluded to by journalists and from which they certainly didn't talk about was the possibility that Columbia might be photographed by America's spy satellites.
And that's what they did, was it?
It was. There'd been always an understanding. And in fact, as early as the launch of Skylab, when American spy satellites were used to assess the damage to Skylab after it was launched, this capability had been a possibility. What hadn't been possible until the launch of Columbia was the transmission of real-time photographs digitally from space. And prior to that, they'd had to drop capsules from space, which were picked up over the Pacific by the Air Force, flown back to Hawaii, then flown from Hawaii to Rochester, where Kodak would develop them. I mean, this process took days. But Columbia was only on orbit for 3 days, so that wasn't going to work. And so this was the first time that the digital spy satellite, the KH-11, which had been developed in around sort of in parallel to the space shuttle itself, was used to take pictures of a spacecraft on orbit. And they got those pictures and they were looked at in mission control on Sunday night.
It's amazing hearing you say that there were issues with the tiles on the very first flight, because I interviewed Eileen Collins for a Space Boffin special, and she was the first woman commander of the space shuttle, and she had to command the shuttle the first flight after the Columbia incident.
That's right.
And tiles came off on her flight too. So right from the beginning, I mean, that's quite a design flaw, isn't it?
It's certainly a design challenge, but it in terms of whether or not it was a flaw, I mean, it's debatable in that if they were going to build a spacecraft like the shuttle, they had to look at the alternatives.
Tiles,
they had
yes.
to have a heat shield
or
of
a heat
sorts.
Shield, yes.
And the other possibilities, using metal shingles, which buckled and were impossible to sort of put together, or a single heat shield, ablative shield, like they'd used on Apollo, was not going to be possible. This, if they were going to build something like the shuttle, was really the only possibility. And actually, they worked. This was something that it's often not given credit for, that system, is it was more robust, really, than perhaps the loss of Columbia suggests that it was.
Well, it makes it, I suppose, also makes it even more amazing that they went up with human beings without doing an unmanned flight first, yeah. You know, it's astonishing.
I mean, it was interesting in that, and I think it was they were fitted to the early shuttles, that they had ejector seats.
They did.
Which was possible when you had two crew, because you had the commander and the pilot sitting next to each other. It was like a aircraft. But that was impossible when you had the others sort of tucked away
in the
lower deck.
No, those first four test flights had ejection seats, and they were the same seats that they used, the Air Force used in the Blackbird spy plane. And they were good to, 150,000 feet and beyond that, as we heard in the Strand digest of the flight, they were good to a certain altitude and then not beyond that. But what was interesting from the point of view of Bob Crippen and John Young is that as far as they were concerned, there was no possibility of them pulling those ejection seat handles and surviving, because they'd been thrown straight into a sort of 300-foot-long rocket plume coming out of the solid rocket booster. So, they'd burnt to a crisp.
So was the design fundamentally flawed? I mean, the whole idea of strapping a space plane to a massive tank of fuel with solid rocket boosters on the side, and then even an ejector seats that would fling them out sideways into the exhaust.
Well, it was certainly a compromise. It was not what NASA had first wanted or intended. They'd imagined having a completely reusable booster which had the performance of the X-15 rocket plane but was the size of a 747. And possibly, and I've spoken to people during the research who've suggested that thank God they didn't go down that route, or they'd never have flown anything. That was just too challenging a design to make work. So this was a compromise. It was a compromise based on what was possible. It was a compromise based on what was affordable. And it was also a compromise that worked. But you're right in saying that, with respect to the things that NASA considered important for manned spaceflight, which was that you would never put your crew below something that could hurt them. You'd never use solid rocket boosters. And you'd never fly without having first flown an unmanned mission. They broke all three of those rules.
Now, you've written quite a few books on aviation, including the British Vulcan bomber. So do you see the space shuttle more as a space plane, with the emphasis on plane?
Certainly how I came to the story, and actually through coming to the space shuttle story, it's generated an interest in all things space for me. But, I grew up in the 70s sort of obsessed with Battle of Britain stories and Dam Busters and things like that. And so the stories that I told Vulcan 607 or another one about HMS Ark Royal in the 70s, they were all generated by a love of aviation. And the shuttle was the first spacecraft that captured my imagination, because I was born in 1970, and so I was too young for Apollo. I was 10 years old when the shuttle launched, and here it was, this spacecraft that was a real spaceship. It had a crew the size of the Millennium Falcon. It had wings. It came back and landed on a runway. Then it was launched again, and the whole thing was kind of Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers, and I hope that I've been able to bring that same sort of enthusiasm, childish enthusiasm, to Into the Black as I have to those first books. I mean, I hope it reads like a real-life thriller.
I love it. I mean, I think it's great. I think it's great. It sort of made me... I've always been quite critical of the space shuttle because of all these issues with it and all the compromises along the way. And really the fact that it should have been built in parallel with the space station to have a purpose. There are lots of issues. But reading it, I've got quite nostalgic.
Oh, good.
For it. Because when you see that little Soyuz, you see the three cosmonauts, astronauts sort of crammed up in this little Soyuz. They can't bring anything back from space. It's a big issue at the moment. You can't bring anything back from the space station. And you look at the shuttle in comparison, this amazing,
and it's when
enormous
you see
craft.
When you see the shuttle
people.
As well in museums in America.
That struck me.
That really gets you like, wow, actually, this is pretty big. And you see
absolutely.
Those tiles too, and you see the scorch marks on the underbelly of the one at the at Cape Canaveral. It's much more impressive than, you're used to seeing it on a small TV screen, I suppose.
I mean, I think that was certainly an ambition for the book, was that, as I say, I was amazed by it when it first launched. I followed it. I mean, I was taping on cassette the commentary on the BBC as it was going. And I want to try and recapture that sense of amazement, of awe. I mean, partly because of its success in that it did take things into space and bring them back, over a long career, but also because of the loss of two shuttles as well. Its career was characterized either by tragedy or by a sort of over familiarity and sort of meh. And it deserved better than that.
It's true, because at the time when I was working as a science correspondent for the BBC, I would cover space missions. And it got to the point where, you know, a shuttle launch was just like,
well, the thing is, they were always delayed.
Unless it went wrong. Yeah. Unless it went wrong.
And the problem was, they were always delayed. I was there as a pundit, for example, on BBC World TV, you know, sitting there like a lemon, talking as the countdown went, and then at 2 minutes, the clock has stopped.
It's difficult, it didn't start again
for 3 weeks, you know.
The thing, though, for me, that, for me personally, was a slight disappointment with the shuttle. It's purely visual. Although it was exciting to see the parachutes open when it hit the runway, at the same time, I just felt, couldn't you come up with something slightly more high-tech? Than a bunch of parachutes.
True. Well, I mean, of course, the first few flights didn't use parachutes. They just used the length of Edwards Air Force Base, Dry Lake. And for me, again, that was part of the appeal of the story. And Richard talked about whether I'd come... you talked about whether I'd come to it through aviation. And I had, insofar as... For me, the shuttle represented the apex, the apogee, perhaps better expression in this company, of American post-war aviation development, you know, stretching right back to Chuck Yeager and the X-1 and the sound barrier over the Mojave Desert. You know, for a period of about 25 years, every new design that had sort of been wheeled out of American aerospace factories flew faster and higher than what had come before. I mean, it was a tremendously exciting, intense world where design and development and speed and, you know, these test pilots were fantastically glamorous. And in the mid-70s or so, that just came to a stop as avionics and electronics became more important than the power of the engines and the shape of the airframe. But the shuttle was the last iteration of that. It was the fastest and highest flying machine that had ever been built.
I'm just going to make you slightly jealous. Regular listeners to the podcast will know this, but you won't. Because I wrote to NASA as a teenager saying I wanted to be an astronaut, they sent me back letter of encouragement, and they included a technical manual, and this was in the 70s, so it was way before it was launched, of their latest project, and it was the space shuttle.
Wow.
So I have this lovely 1974 manual from NASA about the space shuttle, and you're not having it.
No, I have to have a look at it.
If we're on making people jealous, I've landed the space shuttle. I landed the space shuttle in the shuttle simulator, and I didn't crash. I mean, first time I did career off into the marsh, but no one died.
Prince Charles, as I mentioned in the book, managed to crash it a number of times when he went to fly the sim. And I mean, even Fred Hayes, who famously was on Apollo 13 and flew a number of the atmospheric approach and landing tests off the back of the 747. He nearly crashed it on the last flight as they were trying to sort out the fly-by-wire controls.
Well, they did say it flew like a brick, didn't they?
They did say it flew like a brick, and I think it did. But they also, it was very responsive. I mean, because it had been, all the controls had been designed by fighter pilots, essentially, it did fly a bit like a fighter pilot. And you may have landed it, Richard, but Joe Engel, who was the pilot on the commander on the second test flight, he barrel rolled the simulator. He managed to get the simsips to tweak the controls so he could both land and take off and just do fly circuits, but he also barrel rolled it as well. And the other thing that the two of them, Joe and Dick Truly, would do as they flew together was they realized that they could actually flick a switch, which meant both control sticks had the same authority. And so if one of them moved the stick to the left and the other moved the stick to the right in perfect harmony and carefully enough, nothing would happen and keep flying straight and level. And Joe could then say to the guys on the desk, look, I'm trying to fly full left and nothing's happening. What's going on? Nothing's broken. And actually, this was the way in which they worked out how to fly those approach and landing tests and squeeze so much into a really short 2 minute flight was by flying it together and coordinating the stick and rudder movements on either side of the cockpit, almost like a ballet. I mean, it was incredible what they squeezed into those short flights.
Well, Roland, do stay with us, because in a moment, an awkward moment on Apollo 10. But this is the Space Boffins podcast in partnership with the Naked Scientists. You can get in touch with Space Boffins on Twitter and Facebook and all our past podcasts, including the extended interview I did with Shuttle Commander Eileen Collins. They're all on the Naked Scientist website. And if you can't wait another month for the next Space Boffins, we've made a series of audio essays for BBC Radio 3 on interstellar travel. It's called Another Giant Leap. It's presented by, you might recognise a few names here from our podcast guests, Stuart Clark, Rachel Armstrong, Cameron Smith and sci-fi author Stephen Baxter. And you can find them all on the Radio 3 website.
Now, if you're eating, you might want to spool forward a minute or so because we've got a recording to play you from another John Young mission, Apollo 10. A dress rehearsal for the moon landing. Now, this 1969 incident concerns an issue with the primitive toilet system on board, which involved plastic bags and tape, and they didn't always seal properly. So in the capsule, alongside Young, we have Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan and an unwelcome visitor.
What's happening?
Oh, who did it?
Who did what?
What?
Who did it? Give me a napkin quick. There's a turtle loose.
I didn't do it. It ain't one of mine.
I don't think it's one of mine.
Mine was a little more sticky than that. The one who
God almighty.
What do you see?
Nothing. That's enough for me.
It's the Apollo 10 loose turd incident. There is more of that. There are actually two clips.
I did put the transcript up on the Space Boffins Facebook page weeks ago, and you read it and you just, and they're all denying it. The funny thing is that they're all denying it was them. You know,
wow. I have to just thank the producers of The Last Man on the Moon for providing clip. And the film about Gene Cernan gets its US release on the 26th of February, and it should be released in other countries later in the year. Yeah, it's not surprising they didn't publicise that much at the time.
Right, well, moving swiftly on, Europe's latest Mars mission will launch in a few weeks. ExoMars 2016, a joint venture between the European Space Agency and the Russian space agency Roscosmos, consists of the trace gas orbiter and an entry, descent and lander demonstrator. Now, the orbiter carries four scientific instruments, including a high-resolution camera called Cassis. Its principal investigator, Nicholas Thomas, is a British professor of experimental physics at the University of Bern in Switzerland. And being the international world of science, naturally I caught up with him to talk about Cassis on the streets of Rome.
Well, I'd like to call it the second best camera system that's ever flown to Mars.
Why the second best?
Because the best was an instrument that the Americans built called HiRISE, which gave 25 centimetres per pixel observations of the surface of Mars. I mean, basically you're looking at a rock no wider than your shoulders. From 250 kilometres above the surface of Mars. So HiRISE takes something to beat. But we didn't have enough mass on the spacecraft, and the volume that we had available was much smaller. And so we designed an instrument that was more compact. It's not quite as high a resolution, but it's got more capability in terms of colour and stereo capabilities.
And what do you hope to do that hasn't been done by orbiters around Mars already? Because there seem to have been so many of them.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, it's
and there's some of them still there, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. A HiRISE included. I mean, it's a fair question. One of the things that we're looking to use Cassis for is to look at dynamic phenomena. One of the things about the orbiter, the trace gas orbiter, is that it varies in terms of time of day. What that means that we can do is that we can look and see how phenomena change during the day. So, for example, we might be able to see how ice condenses onto the surface in the mornings, but yet it is gone by the afternoons. This is particularly important for looking at what we think is liquid water on the surface. Now, there's a structure which we've seen using HiRISE. These structures have got a name. They're called recurring slope lineae. As usual, scientists like to invent a name which confuses the general public.
You know, it's not a catchiest of titles, is it?
Yeah, but that's one of the things that we like to do. You know, that's what scientists are supposed to do, right? RSL, these lineae, they're dark features which appear during spring on Mars. They get longer with time. They fade during autumn, and then the next year they repeat. So they go through a seasonal cycle. always in the same place, always the same type of structure. Now, the thought is that these are connected to melting of a sort of a water-salt mixture. The thing is that with high-rise, we only ever observe these things late afternoon. And what we're kind of expecting is that we should be seeing these things growing during the day. In order to do that, CSIS can observe these areas at 8 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock. Okay, it takes a little bit of time and several orbits to do that. But in principle, we can look at these types of targets as a function of time of day. And,
so it's almost like looking at a seasonal lake at different times.
Yes.
In that you're seeing it larger at some times of the day, at some times of the year, and smaller at others.
Yeah. These tongues of material, these lineae, and they're called lineae because they're like line-like, there's no doubt that they extend during the season. And then they seem to fade away into the background again as you move towards autumn and winter. And that's
so if that's seasonal lake, really, it should be seasonal river, shouldn't it, if there are these lines?
It's rather like a sort of a little dribble of water that running down on a sandy slope.
This is something new for Mars, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that we put in science, and we had a science paper about it.
Almost like the canals, isn't it? The sort of sci-fi thing, seeing the canals.
Yeah. And there is a little bit about that because, you know, we're not 100% sure that it's water. We've never got a really good signature of a water absorption line from these areas, which makes life a little bit difficult.
And could CSIS do that or any of the other instruments that will be on ExoMars?
Unfortunately not. What we can do is simply to try to monitor these things and to see if they're continuing and try and look for more of these areas. But unfortunately, we don't have a high enough resolution infrared spectrometer to be on the spacecraft to be able to attack exactly that problem.
Which sort of sets you up for another mission, effectively, doesn't it?
Unfortunately for the taxpayer, perhaps, yes.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting.
It's good stuff. And you know, it's not the only thing that we can do with CSIS. It's just one of the lists of things where we can look at, for example, at monitoring how the wind is influencing the surface on diurnal timescales, following dust devils over time and so on. Looking at the evolution of the polar ice caps over longer periods of time. CSIS it provides a good complement to the instruments that have gone in the past. And although we can't beat high-rise in terms of resolution, we can certainly complement it in terms of colour and the stereo capability that we have.
CSIS, I think of a blackberry or a liqueur involving blackberries.
Yeah.
What does it stand for?
CSIS is the Colour and Stereo Scientific Imaging System. We made it up. I just happen to like CSIS. I like Kia Royale.
Who doesn't?
And there's also a CSIS near Marseille that makes an excellent rosé, actually, from that area. So, and there's some nice pictures of me, which are not going to go anywhere near Facebook, drinking some of that stuff. So it's kind of
Nicholas Thomas, in charge of the, I think, blackcurrant, actually, rather than blackberry, CSIS camera on ExoMars, currently due for launch in March.
So European, isn't it? Naming it after an alcoholic beverage.
Well, that's what we Europeans...
The Americans would never do
that. Well, that's what we Europeans do better than the Americans, actually. Well, we're better at drinking.
I'm a whole lot more low rent than him. When I think of CSIS, I think of what you add to a snake bite to turn it into a purple nasty.
Oh, that's that ages you, doesn't it?
Yeah. Because yeah, probably, that, yeah. that everything that's ages the, me now.
Yeah.
Excellent. And obviously, it should go with juice. For
yes,
Jupiter's
the
juice.
Which is the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, which doesn't even work.
No.
Doesn't make any sense.
When you get a spacecraft that's got some instrument called a margarita, then I'll be really...
Then we'll know. Well, I was wondering, because they said... I remember we interviewed Andrew Coates, who's principal investigator on juice, and he said they named it after a few gin and tonics. And I think that actually you could call it gin. So it had to be J-I-N. And it could be Jupiter Icy Navigator.
Oh, yes. So I thought
that would
be much
better.
You'd have to have tonic. There would have to be some other instrument that would work with it. Suggestions on a postcard or a Twitter, please.
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, in 2 years' time, Europe and Russia will launch their second ExoMars mission, and this will carry a rover. It'll have a lot to live up to. NASA's Opportunity rover has just celebrated its 12th anniversary on Mars, and it's still going strong. John Grant, a geologist at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., is one of the senior scientists on NASA's Mars rover missions. I asked him what he thought about the fact that Opportunity was still working.
Astonished, maybe 5 years ago. At this point, it's just, you know, beyond belief. It's an incredibly capable spacecraft, having run the distance of more than a terrestrial marathon at this point on Mars, when its goal was to, you know, go on order of a kilometer or less.
Give us a sense of its achievements then. What has it done?
Opportunity and, of course, its twin sister Spirit, which stopped operating several years ago, both were sent to Mars to try to understand the role of water in shaping the surface. And both were very successful in that regard, Spirit finding evidence of an ancient environment where steam was occurring around a volcanic center in Gusev Crater that may have been akin to the kinds of things you might see where fumaroles or steam vents are found around Hawaii or maybe even in Yellowstone. For Opportunity and Meridiani Planum around the other side of the planet, we found a long history of water that has contributed to shaping the surface. It looks like it was sort of a dry-ish environment where it must have rained or water puddled on the surface occasionally, and we had an active groundwater system. And those rocks formed the goal of our investigations during the first years of the experiment. But for the past 3 to 4 years, we've been on the rim of a very ancient crater called Endeavour, and now we're looking at the role of water in shaping Mars really in the ancient past, even earlier than the rocks formed that we were first looking at.
Now, water is the key here, and also there's recent evidence from Curiosity as well. Is it fair to say there was absolutely water flowing on the surface of Mars?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, absolutely. With Curiosity, we see evidence of deposits coming off the north rim of Gale Crater that could only have been deposited by water draining across the surface and forming a deposit, much like we might see in Death Valley here on the Earth. It's called an alluvial fan. And we also see evidence that water then puddled in the center of the crater and created a lake. We see evidence of shallower water puddling in Meridiani Planum, where Opportunity is. And we see, based on analogy with those deposits and using our orbital assets, evidence from orbit that, in fact, water has flowed and puddled on the surface elsewhere as well.
And what sort of time scale are we talking about? Can you say how long ago the last water flowed?
Most of the water looks to have been around sort of in the 3.5 to 4.5 billion year period. So a very, very long time ago, and tells us that early Mars was a very different place than it is today.
Everyone's excited about water because water on Earth means life. Is there necessarily a connection, particularly as we talk about so long ago that water last flowed on the Red Planet?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a connection, but as you say, where we find water on the Earth, we find life. So there's definitely a good path to follow there, and that's one that we are taking now that we understand more and more about how and when water occurred. As we learn more and more about the past climate and how clement it may have been, we can start to pinpoint the locations where the rocks might best record evidence of past life. And the 2020 rover, which will be launched in 2020, will in fact start to probe a little bit in more detail at the rocks, build on the sort of habitability results from Curiosity, and start to look for things that we call biosignatures, a next step towards understanding whether there was ever life on Mars.
And what about the ExoMars program? Because that's the European program between now and the 2020, Mars 2020. You've got the ExoMars 2016, which is just going to have a lander and an orbiter. Then 2018, you've got a rover, and this will have a drill fitted to it capable of drilling into the surface.
Yeah, we have a drill on Curiosity, but it doesn't go very deep. Typically, as we look for outcrops where they've been eroding quickly, so that when we sample those rocks with Curiosity, in fact, we can get material that may not have been super exposed to the sort of harsh environment of Mars. ExoMars really has an advantage there because the drill can go down about a meter, and in so doing can get much deeper down into the surface, go to one of these fresh outcrops that I described, dig down up to a meter with its drill, and hopefully sample some material that hasn't been much altered by that Martian environment. So really might make a good stride towards understanding the past history of Mars and the possibility of whether there was life.
John Grant, a senior geologist on NASA's Mars rover missions. And I know Americans normally do things bigger, but I'm pretty sure our drill is bigger than that. I think it goes down further than 1 meter. Anyway, we're going to celebrate another anniversary now that's quietly passed most people by, but not by space boffins. 50 years ago, in February 1966, the Soviet Union achieved the first controlled soft landing on the moon when Luna 9 touched down in the Ocean of Storms. The robotic probe sent back pictures and proved that the lunar surface was solid and not formed of some sort of dusty quicksand.
A model of the Luna 9 probe is currently on display at London's Science Museum as part of the Cosmonauts exhibition. And as videos played around us, I asked space curator Doug Millard how the Luna 9 landing was treated at the time.
It certainly made headlines, and as far as we can tell, it was deliberately so. The image that was transmitted back to Earth was on a frequency that could be picked up readily. Jodrell Bank, the radio telescope at in Cheshire in England, did so, and the Daily Express, I believe, got hold of it. And these pictures from the lunar surface were transmitted around the world, and I'd imagine that was quite deliberate.
Now, at the same time, 1966, things were ratcheting up on both sides in terms of getting a man on the moon. And what point was the Soviet Union at in terms of reaching that goal?
Well, we tend to think of Project Apollo, of course, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin touching down on the moon in 69. Kennedy started that program way back in 61. Now, the Soviets didn't really start to get their act together for another 3 years, and then it wasn't until the end of 1965 that the late chief designer Sergei Korolev was put in charge of the Soviet moon landing program, and within days of that he had died. So they were intending to get to the moon, but they were having to catch up.
And they were developing this N1 rocket, which, I mean, it was an extraordinary machine if it had ever worked.
The N1 was a massive beast. It was the same height pretty much as the Apollo Saturn V. Was designed to do the same sort of thing, get a lander up onto the lunar surface, another spacecraft in orbit around the moon, but it went about it in a quite different way. One of the problems was that the first stage had 32 engines compared to the Saturn V's 5, and that first stage was never ground-tested with all 32 engines firing. They went straight to flight status, and when they ran into the problems, it just contributed to the challenges the Soviet program was facing.
Well, although the N1 never launched successfully, the rest of the hardware for a Soviet moon landing was developed, tested, and even flew. Taking pride of place in the Cosmonauts exhibition next to the car-size Lunokhod rover, the towering 5-metre-high Russian moon lander. Made up of a bulbous cabin attached to 4 hefty legs, the lander was only designed for a single cosmonaut, most likely the world's first spacewalker, Alexei Leonov.
Peering through that, I like to call it the windscreen, this circular window angled down towards the lunar surface, you can picture Leonov controlling his descent, and he had even less time than Neil Armstrong had in order to find somewhere to land. So it would have been even more dangerous, perhaps, than Apollo.
And presumably they had thought all this through. They'd developed a spacesuit suitable for the moon. They'd worked out what Leonov would have done on the moon. I mean, he wouldn't have been able to do a great deal, I imagine, and he certainly wouldn't have been able to fit much rock back in that capsule with him.
Well, rather like Apollo 11, the first landing would have been a pretty quick affair. Get some samples and back you go. The spacesuit, the Krechet spacesuit, was designed especially for the cosmonauts to walk on the lunar surface, alas, never used. Interestingly, alongside we have something else that was launched successfully to the moon, the Lunokhod. That was originally part of the manned program.
So how would that have worked? You'd have the rover and a person on the surface.
Leonov, for example, would land in this large lander. Previously, though, an unmanned version would have also landed some distance from Leonov's on the lunar surface. That would be used in the eventuality of some sort of failure on Leonov's lander. The Lunokhod would also have been launched prior to Leonov's landing in order to act as a beacon to help guide in Leonov, and also to be used in the event of that emergency by Leonov to drive to the other backup lander and thereby return safely to the Earth. So Lunokhod originally was all part of the Soviet manned lunar program.
How different, this is a very speculative question for a historian, how different would the world be if it was Leonov as the first man on the moon rather than Neil Armstrong?
Well, if Leonov had been first on the moon, the flag would have been different, but I guess it would have still wobbled about for all the reasons we know, because once you touch a flag on the moon, it doesn't stop wobbling for a long time. So I think you'd have had a wobbling hammer and sickle.
And so you would have exactly the same conspiracy theories that we never landed on the moon if it had been a Russian or an American.
Absolutely, yes, it would be all the same all over again.
Isn't that great? Space curator at London Science Museum, Doug Millard. And the Cosmonauts exhibition is on until the 13th of March. I should mention that although the Russians haven't yet landed anyone on the moon, the two Lunokhod rover missions of 1970 and 1973 were a success. And the Soviet Union also managed to bring back moon rock with three successful robotic sample return missions. So, I mean, if you look at it, maybe Russia didn't really lose the race to the moon. They certainly did it a different way. And I think what's interesting about that is they came up with a completely different way. I mean, they had a lander, but they had the idea of two landers and a robot to connect the two if there was a problem. They did everything in parallel, almost like a parallel world. But, Roland, that the same cannot be said for their version of the space shuttle, which the Buran, which, I mean, it's pretty much a rip-off, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think there was some disappointment amongst Soviet rocket engineers and aerospace designers that was the case. They developed a space plane of their own in the 70s and even had a small cadre of cosmonauts who were expecting to fly that at some point. And that was called Spiral. And when the decision was taken as a direct response to the Americans' development of the space shuttle to build a Soviet equivalent, and really in nothing more than the ultimate case of keeping up with the Joneses, they simply copied the mold shape, the plan for the shuttle. And the reason for that was, as one of the administrators said to the designers, the Americans are not dumber. And they spent a fortune spying on what the Americans were doing and getting hold of information. And a lot of it actually was released in any case, because NASA's releases everything.
It has to, yeah.
They just thought, let's use American research. And they saved themselves a fortune by doing that. But and of course they did fly it once and unmanned again. But there were a few refinements to that Soviet shuttle, in that it didn't use solid rocket boosters. It used liquid rocket boosters, nor did the shuttle itself, Buran, have rocket engines in the back. It only had sort of orbiting maneuvering rockets. But it was a incredible achievement by the Soviets, even notwithstanding the help they had from the American research.
Roland White, thank you very much for joining us. And your book on the American space shuttle, Into the Black, is out on March the 10th, obviously available now to pre-order. And that's the Space Boffins podcast. We're produced by Boffin Media in partnership with the Naked Scientists and supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium and with a grant from the Royal Astronomical Society.
And next month, I'll be reporting from the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop in, get this, Chattanooga. And if you're going, do say hello. Otherwise, do get in touch through Facebook and Twitter. And thanks so much for listening.
We'll end with an extract from Apollo 14, the third mission to the moon, to commemorate moonwalker Ed Mitchell, who died a few days ago on the eve of the 45th anniversary of the landing.
114 hours, 22 minutes after leaving Earth, Alan Shepard stepped onto the moon. 4 minutes later, he was joined by Ed Mitchell.
The last one is a long one.
Following the tradition of two previous missions, Shepard and Mitchell planted the flag in the lunar soil.
How's this, Bruce? Look okay?
Roger, that's a good sight.
Hmm.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.